Welcome to the podcast of MotorWeek, television's original automotive magazine. MotorWeek is made possible by RockAuto.com. Here's your host, John Davis.
Hello and welcome to MotorWeek's podcast number 73. I am John Davis, and joining me today for this podcast are our producer, writer, and two-wheeling reporter, Brian Robinson.
Hola.
Our Over the Edge reporter, Stephen Chupnik.
Hey.
Or Steve to his friends. Associate producer, Ben Davis.
Hello there.
And joining us for the first time on our podcast is our newest writer and researcher, Patrick Lucas. Patrick, welcome.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
Okay, we've got a lot going on today for this podcast. We have a lightning round, the mailbag as we normally do, and we've got a lot of cars and events and segments to get through. And the first way we're going to do this is by tackling two Mustangs that are coming up on shows only a short distance apart. Let's start with the Ford Mustang GT with the 5-liter, which got substantial changes this year. And then we'll move on to the other one, which whose name will remain silent for a minute or so. Okay, Mustang GT. We've seen the evolution of the Mustang. We've tested all the latest Camaros. Where do we stand in the pony car wars?
I'm firmly in the Mustang camp, especially now with the new GTs. Not big changes, like you said, 8 more horsepower, I think. But it looks a lot different for the little bit that they did change. The new front end, new rear. It's got the LED tail lamps now.
It's high quality.
It looks good.
Yeah. But if you could say before it looked like a off-the-rack suit, nice, presentable. But now it looks like a tailored suit.
The refinement in all of the Mustangs. I mean, it really started with the Bullet last year. But now they're all just incredible.
A lot of things from the Boss have trickled down throughout the lineup. You know,
Boss,
you can get
sorry,
the, yeah.
Sorry. I'm thinking of the Steve McQueen. Where are you?
I am a big fan of the Bullet Edition.
No, but that's the Boss was the one that we just, it was just an amazingly cohesive piece of work.
Yeah, and a lot of those parts have trickled down now throughout the lineup. You can get the upgraded brakes, engine cooling, the Recaro seats that we loved. So it's all trickled down through the lineup.
I thought the interior, it's not overdone. It's not simple, but it's not overdone, and it really doesn't make you have to think when you're driving the car. You just enjoy driving the car.
You know, we spent a lot of time lately talking about the sort of the reemergence of some of the affordable cars with front engine rear drive, notably the FRS from Scion and BRZ from Subaru. But you know, that's what the pony cars were and are. That's what the Mustang is and the Camaro. I mean, to me, if I still think the Mustang's probably one of the best values in a performance car that's ever been done, period.
Can't argue that, for
all
sure.
Right. Let's take this up a notch and talk about the Ford Shelby GT 500, 662 horsepower, the last car that went into production before Carroll Shelby passed away. All right, so you got the regular Mustang and the GT 500. Are they kins, or is the GT 500 really a world apart, or what? How do you view that?
I would say it's definitely a world apart. I mean, it's a whole different car. It's a beast, for sure. And you already said value on the GT. I mean, 662 horsepower, you know, tweaked interior, total transformation to the exterior, and it's like 55 grand, something like that. It's insane.
Well, you know, if you start looking at cars that may be worth a lot of money in 20 years from now, that's got to be at the top of your list.
It's definitely the scariest and most fun car I've ever driven down the quarter mile track in my life.
Tell me about it. When I know you came back a little bit, I wouldn't say white faced, but you were surprised.
Oh,
but
my.
You know, you mash the throttle, you hold on, you got Armco on, you know, 6 feet off each bumper, and what happened?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, first gear is a dance between slip and grip. I mean, you're moving forward, but you're spinning tires as well the whole time. You nail second, it kind of pushes the end out a little, a couple degrees to the right, closer to the Armco. Second gear is a lot like first gear. Third gear, you get a little bit of rotation, but at that point, you're hunkered down and you're traveling forward, scared to death and loving every second of it.
Now, Steve, I know you were involved a lot in some of the shooting of the car, and you always have a different point of view since you're not always involved with all the performance testing. Did it leave you cold? Did you like the car?
You know, I mean, I think that's one of the cars that I think you, like Ben was saying, you have to know how to handle that kind of car. It's not one of these cars that, I mean, for me, I'm going with the GT. It's a little bit more comfortable for me. Mm-hmm. I think that, at least to me, the 500 is just so far above what I think a normal person needs to have.
Needs have nothing to do with it.
Not needs, but should have.
You work for a car magazine. What do you mean? Well, she should have.
It definitely overpowers you if you don't know what you're doing.
It was a tough car to drive.
It really was.
Around the streets, unless you were really easy on the gas.
I can't imagine what the AC Shelbys must have been like when they were new. I never driven
one
of those.
Beast. This is a lot more refined. So, Patrick, you were still new with us when the GT 500 showed up. So, what was your impression? Because I know you had not driven a car like that before.
Well, I actually didn't get to drive this one, but I certainly heard it and saw the other guys zooming around. I heard their impressions, and I was a little intimidated.
You were intimidated.
Yeah.
Well, I can appreciate being new to the staff and not wanting to wrap something like that around a telephone pole.
Yeah, wait until you've been here a few years.
If you guys want to get one, it becomes I'm game.
Did you think, though, when you saw the car, did it do anything for you? I mean, you can't see Patrick. Patrick's one of the youngest folks on our staff. And I'm curious whether the younger generation, something like the GT500 appealed to them.
I thought it was a very cool-looking car. I mean, it's definitely got that muscle kind of feel to it and look to it. But, it's got the LEDs. It's got all that stuff that young people...
Stuff, yeah. But it still looks like a muscle car.
I would be very happy.
Thank God. Well, car culture, may you long live. Speaking of car culture, let's move on to our next vehicle, which I have mixed feelings about myself, so I'll save that for last. The BMW, we had two BMW 6 Series in here. We had the M6 convertible, and then we had the 640i Grand Coupe, which is their four-door coupe. Let's start with the M6. Just more power, or was it really a transformation, or is BMW getting a little too fast and loose with the M moniker? What's your opinion?
No, I don't think so. I mean, all the underpinnings are all right off the M5. So, it's no different than that. Big power, hooks up, takes off, fast. I don't know that I want to drive it on an everyday basis, especially when it costs twice as much as a Shelby GT500. But it's a sweet car, no doubt.
Yeah, I had a good time driving it, but I was a little... I don't know if it's just me, but I get disappointed when everything is a button and the transmission's electronically controlled and there's so many different stages of transmission mapping and suspension mapping.
Auto response.
And they say it's the ultimate driving experience, but really, I think the car has all the experience and you're just along for the ride these
days. And
you're
just selecting from a menu what feels best to your tush.
Exactly. A lot of the soul's gone for me. It's just, it's an awesome car, but... To me, it's more of a status symbol car that is awesome to drive on the track if you ever get that experience. But I mean, I'd rather have a 6-speed manual and stripped out, no suspension options, just firm, maybe sport and normal.
It's a beautiful car. I'm sure well-heeled, folks will probably absolutely love it. But, I'm a little concerned about how a lot of these German manufacturers are looking at the performance cars of tomorrow. They're making them so electronic augmented that I'm not so sure that how much pleasure of driving is going to be left, except the head turning aspect. I mean, if you go around that car, everybody looks at you.
Well, and that's the thing is what Brian was saying is that it's $127,000.
Yeah.
And I don't know if, it sounds nice. It definitely drives
wonderfully.
Yeah. But, and not to get back to the price, but, and I mean, I don't know. I don't think that car deserves that kind of price tag. I mean, it's not.
Yeah.
That was half the price.
Is it worth as much as two Shelby GT500s?
Not at all.
Yeah,
not at all.
Nice car, maybe not the one for us. Patrick, anything to add?
I mean, no. I definitely got some looks driving it around. That just might be because I look young and I don't belong in it.
Yeah,
but...
yeah. We know where you got your money from. Patrick, the other 6 Series that we had the Grand Coupe in, which, of course, for anyone that doesn't know, this is BMW's answer to the four-door coupes from Mercedes and Porsche and Volkswagen
Audi
and just about everybody else. Nice-looking car, I think everybody would agree. Beautiful-looking car. Is it Did the extra doors, though, give it some, cost it some of its character? Anybody's opinion? Is it do anything for you? Is it more of what we're talking about, the M6, too electronically augmented? Is it drive as you think a BMW should drive?
I mean, I drove it at the track, and if we're going to talk strictly driving, it was probably the worst BMW driving experience I've ever had. I mean, it's fast in a straight line, but when it came time to do handling, the electronic steering is so quick and there's no feel, and that car is a heavy car. So you're just sawing through there, and you have no idea. There's no weight to the wheel at all, and you're just going by how far your rear end is coming around to how far you need to be turning, because you're getting no feedback at all through the wheel. It was not an enjoyable experience.
Can we assume that probably the buyers that buy that car will not be driving it that way?
That's correct. I mean, that's probably why you buy that car over a regular sedan, which I'm still not sure why, you know, no one's explained to me how a four-door coupe is better than a sedan, but other than styling. So obviously you're wanting to be trolling around South Beach.
That's a good point, too. I mean, I guess it all harkens back to the day of the Mercedes CLS when that first hit the game. That was the game changer, and everybody's been trying to catch up to that.
I remember going to Frankfurt and seeing it and saying it's one of the most beautiful cars I've ever seen, and I couldn't get in the back seat.
It still is. The 640 is a little bit better than that. I mean, I actually got back there and it was comfortable. But to answer your question, I think the car looks pretty.
It is a gorgeous car.
I like it better than the two-door version, honestly.
Steven?
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. I mean, other than, you know, the interior not basically looks the same. I mean, it's all the same in there, but the exterior, if you put them side to side, the convertible versus the four-door, I'd rather have the four-door just from the looks.
It is a beautiful car, though. I mean, I like stylish cars, and so when I saw it, I thought, this is really gorgeous. But it does raise the question, I've never really thought these four-door coupes made that much sense in any way. It seems to me it's the kind of car you build when you've got so much money to burn, you don't know what else to do with it. I would rather see them do something more innovative, I guess.
I'm sure they'll sell every one they make, too.
Yeah, I'm sure they will, too. Patrick, any comments on it? Because I know that was the first time you had experienced
it. I love the look of it. Very comfortable, but yeah, I can't imagine throwing that thing around turns, and I can't imagine anyone who buy it would.
They probably wouldn't. However, a car that does get thrown around corners, and we've done our share of it, coming up next, and that's the Hyundai Genesis Coupe. We liked it the first go around. They've tweaked it. We like it again. Comments. Is Hyundai really on the right track with this car? I mean, originally Genesis was supposed to be this upper-level brand, and the Coupe sort of just, in a way, it just slides into where the Tiburon was, except it just has a rear drive.
Oh, correct. It's nice. I'm probably not as big a fan of it as most people on the staff. We did have the V6, which is certainly the way to go with it. But compared to a Mustang or Camaro V6, I don't think it comes close.
They definitely, I have to give it to them that they definitely brought the goods when they dropped the R-Spec designation. I mean, a lot of people drop R's and S's without really backing it up. Mm-hmm. This car was so tight on the road that I had it over a weekend, and it beat me up. You know, it sprung so stiffly, handles so well. The transmission is so, the ratios are so tight that I was going from first gear to third gear to sixth gear, or I was starting out in second gear, going from second to fourth to sixth. I mean, it's really dialed in for the track with the ratio transmission and the super sights, the suspension, the Brembos and stuff. So on that aspect, it really delivers. If that's what you're looking for, if you're looking for a track car, a true R-Spec car, that's what you're going to get if you buy it.
Well, the big thing for this year changed was styling, and it certainly looks tougher, but it's got these huge fake vents on the hood that I think really detracted from it. I mean, it looked tough from a distance, but when you got up close, I mean, they were so obviously fake. It was beyond ridiculous.
Fake vents never work on a performance car. They just don't. We've gone through every performance car.
Well, there's nice looking fake, and then there's just fake looking fake. These were very fake looking.
I like the look of the car. I like driving the car, but it reminds me, and in a way, I'm surprised that everybody is raving about this car. It reminds me of the criticism that Detroit used to get 20, 25 years ago, even a little longer, when they would do a performance version of whatever it was. And it would be really tight on the track, but you couldn't drive the car on the street. And they got widely criticized for that. And it doesn't seem to be happening this go around. So
that's how I would label this car.
I thought the you know, as far as the exterior, we've all talked about that. But the interior, I noticed every time I had my iPod plugged in to try and move anything, I would be hitting the shift. I mean, every single time I moved, it would move. And everything was so close.
There was not enough room to hook up all the toys everybody wants to hook up.
Pressing even any of the climate controls or any of the video screen was up higher, but any of the controls underneath, I was hitting the shifter every time. That to me, that was kind of annoying when I was trying to drive.
But you know, Stephen, I bet you're the kind of guy that longs for cars when they were dashes were wide, you know, from door to door and all flat, and you had plenty of room to put three or four people in the front seat.
At least somewhere to put your phone. That's where I went. I just went.
So when you recently went to St. Paul, Minnesota, I bet you were in your element. Tell us about that trip.
Oh, this is it's an event. It's called Back to the 50s.
This is the Minnesota Street Rod Association. Right.
And it's the 39th year that these guys have been getting together and setting up this event. And it's just gotten bigger and bigger and bigger.
How many
and bigger.
Cars?
This year there were nearly 12,000 cars, and they beat it by two this year. It was 11,975.
And this is at the Minnesota State Fairgrounds in St. Paul.
Which if anybody just wants to look it up at how big it is, 12,000 cars, you don't see grass. You don't know that there's anything there. I may have seen 1,000 cars out of the 12,000. But there were everything from Nash's, Studebakers, Edsel's.
What impressed you? I mean, you actually got to talk to some of the original members of the group, right?
I think that's what it is. I think some of the original guys are still around, and they just enjoy being and seeing the kids and the younger group of people who are coming in and still embracing the 50s and 40s and 30s style cars that are there.
And I guess that's a point that I wanted to get at. They actually seem to be making a concerted effort to make sure the hobby appeals to a young generation. I'm talking about don't even have their driver's license yet.
Right. I mean, yeah, they set up a group called the Igniters, which is for young kids. It goes up to the teens, but it's really for some of the parents, the parents and the kids, and just so the kids really know what the parents are into and really getting into the cars, because I think some of the older members are afraid of this culture dying.
Yeah, I mean, there's always, you read all the articles about how the American car culture or the love affair with the car is dying, and then you go see events like
anytime you go to a car show, they're always bigger than they were the
unbelievable.
Year before. I don't buy that for a minute.
I don't either.
But this event, I have to say, is,
it surprised you, didn't it?
Well, it surprised me, and I think the people really get into it. There's no competition, and I think that's the biggest, that's really what people are really into. They're they call it food, fun, and family, and friends, and it really is. It's just about hanging out and family is a big thing there. We actually happened to stumble upon a wedding that was happening there.
Happening on the grounds.
Happening on the grounds.
The
and some
That's
of the,
cool.
the, one of the members, they drove off in one of the members' cars. So it was pretty good.
I look forward to the segment coming up on an episode soon of Motor Week. As a matter of fact, I believe it's episode 2 of our new season.
Yeah,
so
it'll
be on towards the second week in September. Okay, let us now turn to our lightning round, where our panelists here have 2 minutes to share their opinions on topics. And our producer is here, Michelle Parker, and she's going to keep the time. And when the time is up, you will hear... How terribly appropriate. And we'll all stop, or we'll start fighting and keep on going. So here we go. Some automakers are eliminating spare tires or making them an option as a way to reduce the weight and increase the fuel economy. Is this really a good idea? And who around this table has a practical experience to talk about there?
Well, another member of our staff recently ran over some items on a highway in our long-term Nissan Leaf and took out both front tires.
Not one, but two.
Yeah, and I guess it did some damage to the sidewall. So, I mean, it has an entire inflator kit or whatever. But they're useless. I mean, you're going to have to flatbed it out. So, I don't know.
What do you think about whether or not it's a good idea?
I think it's a terrible idea. I mean, that could really ruin
that could really ruin your day if you have to get flatbedded and then only to find out that the tire that you need isn't in stock and take a couple days to get there versus, I mean, in the worst case scenario, if you don't know how to change a tire, at least AAA could come out and put it on there for you if you have it.
Steven?
I was going to say the same thing. I mean, you know, I know that I at least, it's, as far as a backup, I at least like to know that it's there just in case.
It's a security blanket.
It really is. It's. I mean, talk about the Leaf. It's kind of like, you know, range anxiety. I know I can get there, but I just want to be able to at least get there. I want to at least know that if I hit something, I have something as a backup.
All right, Patrick. Again, a different viewpoint.
Any? I mean, I can see their side of the article or the argument being.
Weighs 10 pounds or whatever, and it's 10 pounds of mass.
I mean, you're not going to need it until you actually do need it, and then where is it? Well, I wanted to save, I mean, how much fuel economy are you going to get by
They went to Donuts, I mean, the run-flat spare tires that aren't really full size, you know, we all carped about that, but at least that gets you home. And we know they're much more durable than what they say on their sidewalls. I think they all say don't use for more than 50 miles. And I know people have driven cross country in them.
Been there, done that.
And I wouldn't want to try it, but I know people that did. The point is, I would say, you know, if you're going to tell me that I got to give up a little bit of fuel economy so I can feel more secure on the road, I'm going to do it. Yep. So I don't think there's any disagreement among our panel. And there went off our little notice that we're out of time. So we're going to move on now to the Motorweek mailbag. Remember, if you submit your question and we choose the answer or we choose to answer it on our podcast, you're going to get the fabulous pre-shrunk one size doesn't fit all Motorweek t-shirt. Seriously, they're nice shirts, and we're going to be sending one out to Mike, who wants to know, here we go, what advice do you have for someone looking for a used car? Currently, my budget will allow me to spend no more than $5,000. I'm moving for work and would like to get something dependable for the snow. I think Mike is, this may be his first car. I'll start. I know if Pat Goss was here, he'd be probably telling you that it's very tough to get anything very reliable for $5,000. But success. I mean, let's go around the table. Brian, you don't agree with that?
Well, there's plenty of stuff out there. I mean, if that's your budget, I mean, you got to just look and find the best car you can find.
What are you looking for? That's not a bad budget.
Yeah,
really,
I mean, there's plenty of Honda Civics and Corollas out there for that. You mentioned, you know, they're front-wheel drive. You mentioned it being in the snow. As long as you've got some decent tires on there, I think you'll be all right.
There's a handful. I mean, it's not hard to find a used Subaru well within that price range that would be awesome in the snow. Those things are tanks, too. They'll run forever. That's one thing you'd want to look at, forums and stuff, to see reliability and longevity for certain models. If you needed something bigger, certainly a Yukon or a Tahoe would fit the bill, and you could probably get one with pretty high mileage for that money, but it would continue to run forever and get you through.
Who's got a Tahoe with 190,000 miles, and I think that's about what they're selling it for, and this thing's been well maintained. So checking on how well it's been maintained, you know, asked to see all the paperwork, that kind of stuff.
To see if some of these forums will tell you if something does go wrong, they'll tell you usually how much it costs to fix and if you can do it yourself or if it's a dealer-only job and you want to steer away from vehicles that crazy high repairs that only a dealer can do.
I mean, there are certain things about certain cars like overhead cam, drive belts and stuff that can be problems with a high mileage vehicle. And you want to find out if that's been changed.
Sure, sure.
I would say the internet's the best place either. You know, if you're not as familiar, I wouldn't do it yourself on Craigslist. Maybe look at some of the dealer, some of the dealer lots to see what kind of used cars they have. And, you know, they might be able to help you a little more and just say, this is what I have. This is the budget that I have.
And, you know, that's a very good point. Sometimes you can find run-of-the-mill cars like an old Ford Taurus or something Chevy Malibu that's been a fleet car and has been pretty well maintained and is tired, but has been had good maintenance. And they're not spectacular to look at, but they're very serviceable. And you can find those in that price range. Patrick? Ever go car shopping with that kind of budget?
I can't say that I have, but I would definitely agree with Ben. Enthusiast forums are definitely the way to go. I mean,
there's so much information.
You can pretty much find out anything that's ever gone wrong with any car you're looking for.
Yeah, definitely the weak spots where to look.
I got to tell you, the first place I go when I have a problem with my cars is a forum or look at YouTube on how to fix it. It's amazing. It's all out there. Okay, Mike, I hope that helps you with your first car or at least with your affordable car, and let us know what you bought. that kind of brings to an end our Motor Week podcast number 73. I'd like to thank Dave Wainwright, who's been handling the audio engineering chores today. Our podcast creator is Bob Mixter, and the lady who has produced every Motor Week podcast is Michelle Parker, the lady with the bell, or in this case, the OOGA. She keeps us on track and on time. Till next time, I'm John Davis. Thanks for watching Motor Week. We'll see you soon on your local public television station. And don't forget to watch Motor Week on Velocity.
You've been listening to the podcast of Motor Week, television's original automotive magazine. Motor Week is made possible by rockauto.com. For additional information on podcasts, videos, and showtimes, visit our website at motorweek.org. And watch Motor Week, television's longest-running automotive series, each week on your local PBS station.